Blog Talk Radio.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio.
Happy Pride Month. There's a lot to celebrate and much to be concerned about.
We'll also talk about the endangered state of abortion rights.
With constitutional attorney Jeffrey Stone, a Supreme Court expert.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. An area of land the size of China needs restoring if the planet's biodiversity and the communities who rely on it are to be protected, UN agencies said on Thursday. The FAO and UNEP, the Food and Agriculture Organization, and UN Environment Programs call to reinstate at least 1 billion degraded hectares of land by 2030 must also be matched by a similar commitment to the oceans, or else risk a growing threat to global food security, they insisted. Here's Tim Christofferson, head of UNEP's Nature for Climate Branch Ecosystems Division.
If we do this at the necessary scale, it will have benefits far beyond climate change and biodiversity. It will have benefits for food security, for health, for clean water, for jobs. Restoration can benefit all the sustainable development goals.
In a new report marking the start of a decade of ecosystem restoration, the UN agencies warned that humans are already using 1.6 times the resources that nature can provide sustainably. They said that conservation efforts alone will be insufficient to prevent large-scale ecosystem collapse and biodiversity loss, underscoring the need for countries to reprogram their post-COVID-19 recovery and move away from massive subsidies to carbon-heavy sectors such as fossil fuels. Critical health facilities across Africa risk being overwhelmed as COVID-19 infections surge ahead of the real and rising threat of a third wave, the UN Health Agency said on Thursday. In an appeal to authorities to boost life-saving facilities, the World Health Organization, WHO, also warned that vaccine shipments were at a near halt. To date, only around 2% of Africans have received at least one dose of COVID-19 vaccine, compared with 24% globally. In the last 2 weeks, Africa has seen a 20% increase in coronavirus infections compared to the previous fortnight. South Africa has seen a sustained increase in cases. Uganda reported a 131% week-on-week rise last week, and Angola and Namibia have also witnessed a resurgence, WHO said. The UN agency noted that care for COVID-19 patients in Africa has lagged behind other parts of the world. The continent has 2.9% of cases globally, but accounts for 3.7% of all deaths. Finally, food prices around the world have risen at their fastest monthly rate in more than a decade, the UN said on Thursday, fueling concerns over rising inflation in many of the world's economies. In a regular update, the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, said that more costly vegetable oils, sugar and cereals led the increase in May, with prices almost 40% higher than a year ago. The FAO also forecast record world cereal production this year of 2.8 billion tons and a 1.9% increase from 2020. Despite this increase in the overall amount of cereals, the agency noted that the ratio of cereal stocks to the amount consumed is likely to decline further to just over 28%. The rise will further increase food price inflation in poorer nations, which rely on imports of staple foods. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Welcome to Free Thought Radio and happy Pride Month. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. This is Free Thought Radio for June the 3rd, 2021. Annie, Laurie, and I are hosting from the Joel B. Landon and Wanda Y. Bierce Free Thought Library in Free Thought Hall, which is the national office of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin. While Grant Blaschka, again, is engineering remotely from the recording studio Audio for the Arts.
Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which has two purposes: to educate you, the public, about the views of non-theists, that's atheists, agnostics, and other skeptics, and our very firm purpose to keep religion out of government, as our godless, secular constitution requires in the United States. We have just welcomed more than 500 new members in the month of May. Thank you.
In the merry month of May.
In the merry month of May. That made it merrier for us. And if you're not a member, we would love to send you complimentary material about the Freedom From Religion Foundation, including a copy of our newspaper. And you could just ask for info at ffrf.org on the main webpage.
A good show today. In the second half, we're going to talk with one of our country's leading constitutional privacy scholars, Professor Jeffrey Stone, about the Supreme Court, religion, and abortion rights, specifically the High Court's decision to accept a Mississippi case banning abortion at 15 weeks of pregnancy. Since such a ban is unconstitutional under Roe v. Wade, the court's action to take this case is more than ominous.
And in a few minutes, we'll announce some exciting news about Thomas Paine, one of the founders of the United States. In fact, he named the United States of America. We'll tell you how you can participate in an online June 8th Thomas Paine Day.
This week, we're celebrating the birthdays of three free-thinking composers. Broadway songwriter Charles Strauss, who wrote Annie and Bye Bye Birdie, is a lifelong atheist. He was born June the 7th, 1928. Happy birthday, Charles. Cole Porter, another Broadway composer, also an atheist, was born June the 9th, 1891. And the German composer Robert Schumann was born June the 8th, 1810. Schumann rejected his family's Christian beliefs after he was reading the freethinking works of Schiller, Goethe, and many other freethinkers. Schumann's young friend, the composer Johannes Brahms, was also an agnostic and a humanist. And just before Schumann died in 1856, he and Brahms and Clara Schumann, his wife, stopped at the Beethoven statue. That monument was his church and his altar, the biographer John Swafford wrote. Listen for some music by Schumann today, including The Merry Peasant, Traumerei, and Symphony No. 3 in E-flat.
And later on in the show, we'll celebrate Cole Porter and talk about how you can help us honor Thomas Paine on June 8th. And we have an awful lot of news to get through.
The Freedom From Religion Foundation is applauding President Biden for notably excluding the Hyde Amendment from his budget proposal. This religiously rooted amendment, which was introduced in 1976 by the ultra-Catholic Representative Henry Hyde, restricts federal funding for abortion care.
And of course, that means a great deal because one in five women in the United States depends on medical assistance. They are low income. It also affects Indian Health Service plans and Peace Corps women, who are essentially denied abortion care. There are only 16 states that now take over such coverage. So more than half the states, low-income women have basically no right to exercise their constitutional prerogative to end an unwanted pregnancy unless they get help from an abortion fund. So good for Biden, but this is a chance to call your members of Congress to ask them to approve Biden's budget proposal with its exclusion of the Hyde Amendment. And while you're at it, ask them to support the Each Woman Act. That would prohibit federal and state governments from restricting insurance coverage for abortion in public and private health insurance plans. So that's welcome news.
The month of June is a month for LGBTQ plus pride and a great concern. FFRF, nearly 12% of whose members identify as LGBTQ plus, celebrates Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, and Queer Pride Month with the knowledge that even though there's been much improvement, much is still at stake. As President Biden's Pride Month proclamation points out, there's been remarkable progress since the Stonewall Uprising in 69. And that includes the fact that nearly 14% of Biden's agency appointees identify as LGBTQ+, including Pete Buttigieg in transportation and the first openly LGBTQ individual to serve in the cabinet, and Assistant Health Secretary Dr. Rachel Levine, the first openly transgender person confirmed by the Senate. But there are still problems. Even though the House passed the Equality Act, which adds LGBTQ+ as a protected class in the Civil Rights Act, that bill is languishing in the Senate.
And the Equality Act is really vital to equal protection under the law, because more than half our states offer no LGBTQ non-discrimination protection. So you can be fired if you're gay. You can be denied an apartment if you're trans, whatever. You don't have those rights. And transgender girls and women are the new scapegoat of the religious right, with unprecedented numbers of discriminatory bills being introduced hysterically to outlaw or discourage transgender girls. These are young girls from participating in public school sports, kindergarten through the 12th grade. And we are delighted to say that our strategic response team attorney, Ryan Jane, actually testified against such bills here in our home state of Wisconsin. There are anti-trans bills, and he was able to testify both before the Assembly and the House last week. And Dan, I think we have a portion of that.
Here's a little bit of his remarks that he said to the Wisconsin Senate against Bill 323.
My name is Ryan Jane. I'm a constitutional attorney with the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which is a Madison-based national nonprofit that upholds separation between state and church. And we are in opposition to these bills, which would force schools to segregate all athletic events based on their sex assigned at birth. This is the wrong body to address these concerns, with the wrong rule and for the wrong reasons. Ensuring an equal playing field for women's sports is a nuanced question, as I hope has been made pretty clear by the testimony so far today. And the science on it is not as conclusive as others would like you to believe. The right solution to this issue is to allow experts, sports organizations considering the latest science and with input from the trans community, to decide what restrictions are appropriate, if any, at each stage of competition. This is already the approach at the most elite levels, where the NCAA and the International Olympic Committee have issued and updated rules on this topic without any significant problems to date. So since that more nuanced, science-based approach has been effective at the elite level, there's simply no question that a total ban on transgender girls playing in girls' sports at lower levels, where the vast majority of athletes care more about participation than record setting, is not needed. A fair playing field at the Olympic level is certainly good enough for an elementary school soccer team or a JV swim meet. Consider the harm that this bill would do. Trans kids are more likely to attempt suicide because they are already so marginalized. Participating in sports can build confidence and a sense of community, but only if the athlete is part of their community. It should go without saying that a trans female is not likely to want to play with a bunch of boys. The sole effect of this bill will be to drive trans female athletes out of sports entirely. Finally, let's be honest about this bill's motivation. After trying to pass trans bathroom bans around the country, anti-trans legislators have not suddenly discovered a love for women's sports. It wasn't about bathrooms then, and it's not about women's sports now. Trans athlete bans in Wisconsin, as in so many other states this year, are about demonizing trans kids, sending a clear message that they are outsiders in order to score some cheap political points. If you do care about protecting women's sports, this bill is not the way to do it.
So that's Ryan Jane, an FFRF attorney who works with our strategic response team. Go, Ryan. Great testimony. And I would like to point out that it wasn't so long ago that even progressive politicians dared not voice support for marriage equality. The anti-gay marriage activity at the state level seemed unstoppable. In fact, all these states were passing marriages between one woman and one man, until the Supreme Court in 6 years ago issued the Obergefell decision. And so these phony transgender bills are clearly a backlash to that decision, but they kind of harken back to this tendency to scapegoat LGBTQ in our laws.
And a lot of it's religiously motivated,
oh, it's
obviously.
There's no organized opposition to LGBTQ that is not religious in nature. So that's the state church issue here. And I just want to say that dismayingly, since Obergefell was handed down in 2015, it was a 5-4 decision that was written by Justice Anthony Kennedy. Well, he's not on the court anymore. He was replaced by Brett Kavanaugh. And also in the majority in that marriage equality decision was Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She's been replaced by Catholic Myrmidon, as I call her, Amy Coney Barrett. So today we have a clear 6-3 extremist Christian nationalist majority on our Supreme Court. And we are waiting for the Fulton decision to come down. We'll come down sometime in June by the Supreme Court. And that's a case where the city of Philadelphia refused to contract with Catholic Social Charities because they discriminated against placing foster children in LGBTQ homes. And the Third Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in their favor, and then the Supreme Court took the Catholic appeal. So that is another ominous sign. And we know the city will lose. We just don't know the extent of that damage. So there's a long way to go here on Gay Pride Month. I hope that this will open President Biden's eyes to the urgent need to correct and expand the federal judiciary, a third of whom have been appointed by Trump with Christian nationalist specifications. And speaking of transgender laws, this week we saw the picture of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis not only signing into law a discriminatory bill to ban transgender girls from sports, school sports, but making it a religious photo op. He signed the bill at Trinity Christian Academy, which is a private Christian school with bizarre statements of faith, you know, that Armageddon is coming at any moment, and if you don't agree with the church, you're wicked and under a curse, and Satan is a malignant prince of power. We're quoting their mission statement. And a governor, a secular civil governor, went and signed a bill that doesn't even affect private schools at a private Christian school, clearly propitiating the extremists and the Christian nationalists there. So not only signaling his anti-trans bigotry, but his approval basically of you know, theocratic agenda. So we really are seeing great trouble ahead. And that brings me finally to the fact that this week the Freedom from Religion Foundation issued a press release reminding people that our nation's future and our secular republic really rides on defeating voter suppression. Voter suppression is really a secular issue because if you look on it this way, our campaign to defend the principle of separation between church and state is really a way to limit the capture of our government by a special interest group, and that is the far-right theocratic religious interest groups. And we have seen such terrible voter suppression laws passed, and just this week, Texas narrowly escaped passing that only because a number of legislators walked out, and we'll see what happens. But we are facing 198 bills in 41 states to restrict absentee voting, 34 bills in 15 states to limit early voting, 54 bills in 18 states to purge voter rolls, 85 states and 32 states wanting stricter voter ID, attacks on vote by mail, which is so popular. And even though 98% of the members of the Freedom from Religion Foundation are registered voters, all of these laws are intended to make it harder to vote. And what is wrong with this picture?
It's trying to give a religious minority more power than it deserves.
Right,
really.
And also a white supremacist minority control. And so we really, people need to fight and speak out against voter suppression because it really is a secular issue.
So let's take a break. After the break, we will announce some exciting news about Thomas Paine Day on June the 8th, and we will celebrate the songwriter, the birthday of the songwriter, Cole Porter. And then we will talk with the leading constitutional privacy scholar, Jeffrey Stone. We're going to talk to him about the Supreme Court, religion, and abortion rights. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Geller, and we're listening to The Merry Peasant by freethinker Robert Schumann.
And we'll be back in just a minute with more Free Thought Radio.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Margaret Sanger's motto was, "No gods, no masters." This is Free Thought Radio.
Welcome back to Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker, and we're co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. As we said earlier, this week is the anniversary of the birth of the prolific songwriter Cole Porter, born June the 9th, 1891. Cole Porter had to come out of two closets. He was gay and he was an atheist. He wrote many of the beloved standards in the Great American Songbook, including Anything Goes, Night and Day, and Begin the Begin.
Besides his song Live and Let Live in the musical Can Can, Cole Porter's personal philosophy is perhaps best expressed in his 1933 song Experiment, in which he not only praises science, but says that Eve did the right thing when she ate the forbidden fruit. Here is Dan Barker singing Experiment.
Before I leave these portals, like all unfortunate mortals, there's just one final message I would give to you. We all have learned reliance on the sacred teachings of science. So I hope through life you never will decline, in spite of Philistine defiance, to do what all good scientists do. Experiment. Make it your motto day and night. Experiment, and it will lead you to the light. The apple on the top of the tree is never too high to achieve. So take an example from Eve. Experiment. Be curious, though interfering friends may frown. Get furious at each attempt to hold you down. If this advice you'll only employ, the future can offer you infinite joy and merriment. Experiment, and you.
Barker's version of Cole Porter's Experiment. And we also want to call your attention to Thomas Paine Day. That is the death of Thomas Paine that's often been honored and celebrated.
He was also curious and liked to experiment.
Yes, he was. And it's on June 8th, which is a Tuesday night, if you're on the East Coast. And the Freedom From Religion Foundation is joining with the Free Thought Society, the Thomas Paine National Historical Association, the Center for Inquiry, and the American Humanist Association in co-sponsoring an online celebration of the 2021 Thomas Paine Day. It's on Zoom, and the registration begins, the program begins at 6:45 p.m. Eastern Time, 3:45 if you're in Pacific. And there's a registration link, and the best way to find it is to look up our press release that went out today, June 3rd, on the online Thomas Paine Day celebration. You can find that at fffrf.org/, I can't remember, is it press release? Just look for the press release.
Under news, maybe.
Under news. And we helped to MC it. Dan sings his song, The World Is My Country, which you're going to hear momentarily here. And there is a introduction by U.S. Representative Jamie Raskin. You may have recalled that when he was impeachment manager, Jamie Raskin quoted Thomas Paine often. And Raskin is a aficionado of Paine. He's also the co-chair of the Congressional Freethought Caucus. And you're also going to see a sneak preview of the sculpture of Thomas Paine that FFRF and other groups are working to erect in Washington, D.C. Raskin will be sponsoring that resolution. It hasn't been introduced yet. You can see the studio of Zenas Roudakis. It's fascinating to see his maquette, as he calls it, and I think it's now 7 foot tall that he's working on. So you can Google Thomas Paine Day celebration or go to fffrf.org under our news link and look for the press release for that webinar, that Zoom event on June 8th. So here is an excerpt of The World Is My Country, words by Thomas Paine and Dan Barker, performed by Dan.
The world is my country, to do good is my religion. No prophet or priest, no Bible for me, my mind. All that we need to enjoy peace on earth.
So, to hear the rest of that song, be sure to participate in the Thomas Paine Day event on Tuesday, June 8th. Sign up. Go to fffrf.org/news and look for that link under the press release.
So we're going to take a break, and after the break, as we promised, we're going to talk with the leading constitutional scholar, Jeffrey Stone, about the Supreme Court, about religion, and about abortion rights. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. This is a little bit more of Schumann, his Trauma Rye. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
Are you tired of right-wing politicians who desperately want to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us? I know I am. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Join the fight and call the Freedom From Religion Foundation toll-free at 1-800-335-4021. That's 1-800-335-4021. Or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation website at fffrf.org. That's www.fffrf.org. Proud to be an atheist, Janine Garofalo.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. Welcome back. Jeffrey Stone is the Edward H. Levy Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago. We've had him on our show before, at least once, maybe twice. Jeffrey Stone served as a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice William J. Brennan, and he served on President Obama's review group on intelligence and communications technologies. He was the dean of the University of Chicago Law School, as well as provost of the University of Chicago.
Jeffrey Stone's the author of many award-winning books on constitutional law. They include Democracy and Equality, The Free Speech Century, Sex and the Constitution, Sex, Religion, and Law, From America's Origins to the 21st Century, speaking out, reflections on law, liberty, justice, eternally vigilant, like that title, Free Speech in the Modern Era.
Jeffrey Stone is the editor of the new book, National Security, Leaks and the Freedom of the Press, which just came out this spring. He's the editor of two leading case books. He's the editor of the Supreme Court Review and the chief editor of Inalienable Rights, a 25-volume series on constitutional law published by Oxford University Press.
And Professor Stone has written amicus briefs for constitutional scholars in a number of Supreme Court cases, including Obergefell versus Hodges and Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt. And thank you, Jeff, for joining us again today.
My pleasure. Thank you for that extraordinary introduction. I'm really impressed with myself.
We had to cut it shorter. We would just spend the whole time reading all of your accomplishments.
Well, you know your stuff. So we asked you to come on the show, Jeff, because, of course, we are all very concerned about the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court has accepted a case out of Mississippi that would restrict abortion at 15 weeks. It's called Dobbs versus Jackson Health Organization, and so we would like to find out what you're thinking about this.
Happy to help. One thing I should add to the introduction, by the way, is you mentioned that I was a law clerk to Justice Brennan on the Supreme Court. That was at the year that Roe v. Wade was decided, so I was at that time. So the fact that the court agreed to hear this case was pretty shocking. Basically, in Roe v. Wade, the court held that the state could not prohibit women from having an abortion until the fetus was viable, which was the third trimester. And before that, the state could, within very narrow limits, regulate abortion to protect the health of the woman, but could not prohibit a woman from exercising the right. In 1992, almost 20 years later, the Supreme Court had the case of Casey. And at that time, most people predicted that the court would overrule Roe. By 1992, the court consisted of 8 justices appointed by Republican presidents. And the only justice appointed by a Democratic president, Byron White, had dissented in Roe. He was one of the 2 justices who dissented in Roe v. Wade. Nonetheless, in Casey, the court, in an opinion joined by Justices Anthony Kennedy and David Souter and Sandra Day O'Connor and John Paul Stevens, all 4 appointed by Republican presidents, and Justice Harry Blackmun, who was the author of Roe, also appointed by a Republican president, they held that Roe v. Wade was to remain in effect. They made some modest modifications, but unequivocally reaffirmed that the state could not prohibit abortion before viability. And even though they would allow regulations to protect the health of the woman if they were not an undue burden on the woman, there could not be any prohibition on abortion prior to viability. The reason the court in Roe said that abortions could be prohibited at the point of viability was that at viability, the fetus could live outside of the woman. And at that point, the woman could exercise her right not to be pregnant, while at the same time allowing the state to preserve the life of the fetus. But before that, the woman's right could not be prohibited. In the Mississippi statute before the Supreme Court, Mississippi prohibits abortion after 15 weeks, except in emergency circumstances. Both the lower federal district court and the Court of Appeals held that statute unconstitutional, as it clearly is under the precedence of Roe and Casey, because by prohibiting abortion after 15 weeks, it was going much further than Roe, which basically allowed abortion until roughly 24 weeks. And so it was patently unconstitutional. And none of the lower court judges had any question about that. That the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case is shocking, because there's no reason for the court to hear that case if they're simply going to affirm what's obvious, which is that the law is unconstitutional, which gives rise to a great deal of concern that in this case, the court will at the very least, overrule is a critical element of Roe v. Wade and Casey, and uphold the challenged law, even though it prohibits the woman from exercising the right after 15 weeks. And it might even go beyond that. I mean, it might even go beyond that and simply say that there is no right on the part of a woman under the Constitution to have an abortion. So it's a very important and pivotal case. And I think most people are aware that the court would not have taken it if they did not intend to uphold this law.
So can I ask, Jeff, thank you for that. Was there some reasoning behind the number 15? Did Mississippi say there's something about 15 weeks that makes it special?
They basically argue that at 15 weeks, the state's interest in protecting fetal life is sufficiently great to justify the prohibition. There's no argument that at 15 weeks the fetus is conscious or is viable, but their view, it has enough of the characteristics and features of being a person that it wants to define that as the point at which personhood kicks in. And again, that's, as I said, completely inconsistent with what the court had held in both Roe and Casey. But there's no scientific evidence to support that. There's no, it's simply a judgment about what they think is the point at which it's inappropriate to allow a woman to terminate a pregnancy because the fetus at that point, in their view, deserves respect on the part of the state.
So this case, Professor Stone, was sitting before the Supreme Court. They kept punting it for more than a year, or well, not more than a year, maybe 9 months or so before they finally accepted it. And is that unusual?
Yes, it's very unusual for the court to have a case brought before it and not to decide one way or the other whether to hear the case for as long as was true in this situation. Part of it may have been a lack of certainty on the part of the conservative justices as to whether they would have a fifth vote. But after Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed, my guess is that they probably then had confidence among themselves that they would have at least five votes and maybe six with Roberts, although Roberts has been more cautious about this issue than his other colleagues on the court. But my guess is that they didn't want to take the case unless they knew they would have a majority to uphold the statute. And at a certain point, they decided we now have that. They talked about it among themselves, I have no doubt, and therefore they decided it was sensible to take it.
So let's talk about the changes on the Supreme Court since Roe versus Wade, since Casey. I mean, we now have – what kind of court do we have?
Well, we now have six justices who are more conservative than any of the justices on the court at the time of either Roe or Casey. Even though when Casey was decided, eight of the nine justices had been appointed by Republican presidents, not a one of them, with the exception of Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas, was as a conservative as now six of the current justices. So we've had a concerted effort on the part of Republican presidents to stack the court with what I would regard as fairly extreme legal conservatives. And this is going to affect the court's jurisprudence across a broad range of issues. Abortion is one of the most important, but there'll be many others as well. And this is a highly ideological court. I mean, I've spent my entire career writing about and teaching constitutional law, and I've never had a sense of the court being as non-legal as it is today. If you ask, how do you expect these justices to decide a case? And we're talking about, again, highly ideological cases, not routine tax cases or labor law cases or commercial law cases, but cases involving issues that are highly contentious. If you want to ask how the six conservatives will vote, for the most part, it's not about originalism. It's not about judicial restraint. You basically have to ask, what would conservative Republicans like? And you can predict the outcomes definitely most of the time. And that's really disconcerting. I mean, that to me undermines the the integrity and the credibility of the court. An example of how, at least my speculation, about how extremely conservative this court is I would guess that if you asked lawyers or if you asked distinguished lawyers where they would place themselves on the spectrum of the court, I would guess no more than 10 or 15% would put themselves in the place of 6 of the 9 justices today. And that's frankly because the Republican presidents and Senate has stacked the court.
It's non-representative then. From what you suggested a minute ago about the reasons, possible reasons behind them granting cert or agreeing to hear the case, doesn't it look like they prejudged? Doesn't it look like even before the briefing and the arguments, they kind of know what they're going to decide in advance?
I believe that's, in fact, the case. I think they were waiting until they were confident they had the votes they needed. They didn't want to have the case come to the court and have it reach the, quote, wrong, end quote, result. It's not that unusual for the justices to have a pretty good sense of how they're going to vote in the case, depending on the issues that are presented. But in this instance, I really do think the reason they held the case as long as they did was because they weren't prepared to agree to decide the case unless they were confident they knew what the outcome would be. Because the last thing the conservative justices would want is a decision that that struck down the law and reaffirmed Roe and Casey. And so they didn't want to take any risk of that. And I think it was only the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett that made it clear to them that they had a minimum of 5 votes.
And I think they felt they had to wait a little bit of a decorous time before accepting it then, perhaps.
They didn't want to decide it this year. So they wanted to hold it off so they could decide it next year. But it's very disappointing.
When we have talked to you before, Professor Stone, you have predicted that Roe versus Wade would be basically kaput by its 50th anniversary. We have a break. We want to come back and talk to you about the insider's view on Roe versus Wade. You were clerking when it came down, and what's at stake? We are talking with Professor Jeffrey Stone about the upcoming case appeal out of Mississippi that would ban abortion at 15 weeks.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at ffrf.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers.
It ain't necessarily so. This is Free Thought Radio.
It ain't necessarily so. The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we are talking with Professor Jeff Stone about the dangers that Roe versus Wade faces. And we haven't spoken with you, Jeff, since Ruth Bader Ginsburg died last fall, and I know that you knew her and knew several of the other Supreme Court justices. Any comments about her legacy?
Well, I mean, Justice Ginsburg was a remarkable and extraordinarily talented person, and her legacy, I think, both as a lawyer and as a judge and justice, in particular, has to do with the rights of women, although there are many other issues in which she played an important role. But with respect to the rights of women, she was nationally one of the great leaders. And on the Supreme Court, she was clearly a leader. And so her legacy in terms of constitutional law and women's rights will last, I would say, for a lifetime, but obviously that's wrong, forever.
So, but of course, to have her replaced by someone of the ilk of Amy Coney Barrett, so dismaying. And you were clerking for Justice Brennan at the Supreme Court when Roe versus Wade came down. And we only have about maybe 6 minutes left, but I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what that was like to be in the eye of the storm or whatever it was, and the importance of defending Roe versus Wade.
Sure. When the court first agreed to hear Roe versus Wade, it was the year before the decision was handed down. And at that time, there were only seven justices on the court because Justices Powell and Rehnquist, who were nominated by Nixon, had not yet been confirmed. And Justice Blackmun was assigned the opinion by Chief Justice Berger, and his initial inclination was to write a very narrow decision that basically said that the Texas statute prohibiting abortion was unconstitutional because it violated the rights of the doctor. Basically, he said that the state allowed you to perform an abortion if it was necessary to preserve the life of the woman, and necessary is vague. And Justice Blackmun was going to write an opinion which said that statute was unconstitutional because it violated the due process rights of doctors, because they did not know from that language whether they could be criminally prosecuted for what they were doing. So it would have been an extremely narrow and wholly forgettable decision. But the court couldn't quite resolve what it wanted to do. And at the end of the term, they decided we should rehear the case the following year, and that way Justices Rehnquist and Powell would be able to participate. Over that summer, Justice Blackmun spent a good deal of time at the Mayo Clinic, where he'd been on the board, and did research about the history of abortion and about the reality of abortion in the United States. And he came back and educated his fellow justices both to the fact that abortion had been perfectly legal throughout Western culture and in the United States until the late 19th century, and that at the time the Constitution was adopted, abortion was legal and common. And also giving a much clearer sense of what the world was like for women in a world of illegal abortion, the back alley abortion. And because until the late 60s, most women who had illegal abortions did not talk about it. And the women's movement in the late 60s began encouraging women to talk about their experiences, and they were often absolutely horrible. And so this really affected both Blackmun and the other justices. And so in the end, the court, in a 7-2 decision, including three of Richard Nixon's four appointees to the court, including Chief Justice Berger, joined the decision, creating the constitutional right of abortion. And at the time, it was not seen as that controversial. Even Southern newspapers tended to support the decision. The justices had a very clear sense that this was absolutely fundamental to the rights of the woman to decide for herself whether she wished to carry a pregnancy to term, and not to allow the state to interfere with that with a prohibition based upon, basically, the court didn't quite put it this way, but basically upon religious views, and that those were not legitimate or sufficiently compelling justifications for denying the woman the freedom to make that choice for herself. So when the case came down, it was really not very controversial. In fact, when Justice John Paul Stevens was nominated to the court 2 years later by President Ford, not a single member of the Senate asked him a question about his views on Roe or his views on abortion. The issue only became controversial later when the moral majority came into existence. And that was not so much about abortion as it was about gay rights, about women's rights, about the Equal Rights Amendment, all of which they thought threatened what they regarded as the core values of society. And Roe became part of that movement. To this day, you know, over 60% of Americans believe Roe v. Wade was correctly decided and shouldn't be overruled. But there are obviously segments of the society that feel very differently about that, largely, not necessarily exclusively, but largely for religious reasons. And those should not be seen as legitimate justifications to deny an individual what otherwise should be understood to be a fundamental personal right.
So we have 1 minute left, Jeff. Do you have an opinion about the bill that's been introduced that Representative Nadler is supporting to expand the number of the Supreme Court to 13, since we have 13
districts?
Yeah. Honestly, I don't think there is a need to expand the court in terms of the performance of the justices themselves. I mean, my sense is they're capable of doing a reasonably good job of deciding the case that come before them, and but for ideological concerns, there wouldn't be any impetus to increase the size of the court. 13 is the number that's chosen because if Biden was given the four additional nominees, there would then be a 7-6 Democratic majority on the court. Honestly, I would not support that. I think that's not appropriate. I do think it would be appropriate to add two seats to the court, mainly because I think what Mitch McConnell did with Merrick Garland and then with Amy Coney Barrett was a complete violation of the norms of the confirmation process. And had both of them been confirmed, as what should have been the case, then the court would have a 5-4 conservative majority, and adding two seats would leave them with a 6-5 majority. But I don't think that there's an adequate or legitimate justification myself for going to 13 other than pure ideology.
Well, that's an interesting take. We are out of time. I'm so sorry. Thank you so much, Professor Jeff Stone, for joining us today.
My pleasure, always.
And thank you, listeners. We want to thank listeners in Philadelphia, in New Jersey, listeners in Madison, Wisconsin, Janesville, Wisconsin, College Station in Bryan, Texas, Columbia, Missouri, over on the West Coast in Eugene, Oregon, in San Marcos, Texas, and Bellows Falls, Vermont, New Hampshire. I love their radio station. It's called Black Sheep Radio, W-O-O-L, and also in Ithaca and Watkins Glen, New York. And if you're listening to the podcast, give us a thumbs up on your provider and tell your friends to visit our website, ffrf.org/radio.
And ask for more information at ffrf.org or simply join us. So much at stake. And tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, ffrf.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday